BBC. Spoken words appear as text.
Once upon a time, your father, my father, everybody's father, I presume, wanted a good job with a good income to secure their family life, a role in society, and that's where it ended. But now people want to be an individual, and I think there's a lot of searching to find the individual within oneself.
Photographs of a young Bowie, some in Pierrot clown makeup.
Once upon a time, there was a little house.
A modest terraced house.
Just say where you came from.
David Robert Jones from Stanford Road, Brixton. That's the first thing I knew in case I got lost, because I used to wander off a lot.
Baby photos of Bowie.
It wasn't a particularly happy childhood. My parents were cold emotionally. There weren't many hugs. I always sort of craved affection because of that.
Never thought I'd need it. So many people. Girl my age went off ahead. With some tiny children.
And I think there's a passion for most people who have an iota of sort of curiosity about them to escape and get out and try and find who one is.
Small team genius, the streets of London, recording studios, and a fresh-faced Bowie at the start of his career.
Pulling the waiters, talking about Monroe, walking on Snow White.
And I spent all those formative teenage years adopting guises and changing roles and just learning to be somebody. There's a
star. In Bowie's own words, and with the help of his friends and colleagues, this film tells the untold story of
There's a Starman.
David Bowie, finding fame.
Ashes to ash and funk to bucket.
Bowie in a dressing room, dressed as Ziggy Stardust.
Trying to do really quick changes on the encore.
Oh, yeah, there will be.
By 1973, Bowie had become a superstar.
Good
dress, my brother, will be after this.
When she's up sometime.
It had been an 11-year journey with 9 separate bands.
No, I told Ron about some things, as he told you.
Yeah, my dear.
All right? Yeah, and the intro to the show.
But with Ziggy Stardust, Bowie had finally made it. 17th of February, 1973.
What were you doing before you hit the bright headlights? Were you a nobody who suddenly thought, Jesus, I must get into the scene by some other way?
I never asked Jesus for a thing, though. He's always on my own initiative. And when I was 14, I became a mod, and it just carried on from there. I've always dressed in what I considered clothes that prevent me becoming humdrum so that I would receive reaction from people, which would encourage me to write.
A close-up on Bowie's brightly coloured platform shoes. 1965/1966.
London represented a lifestyle, a new kind of language, culturally. It was really fantastic at that point.
Were you writing songs at this period?
Not very good ones, so a majority of the things were other people's numbers. Little Richard stuff and things like that. But I became disenchanted with singing other people's songs. I thought I'd write my own.
Phil Lancaster, drums, the lower third.
He was a nobody within my scope of knowledge of who was in the music industry. But we needed a singer. And different people came. Amongst them was David Jones, or Davy Jones, as he was promoting himself at that time.
The lower third with mod haircuts. Dennis Taylor, guitar.
We were impressed with his voice, although I thought he was going to play the saxophone. He had the alto sax around his neck, and it wasn't until he started singing and we realised that was the point for us, really. We employed him, he didn't employ us, and we employed him.
And this was David's fourth go in terms of bands. Hoping this would be it.
The Conrads, Davy Jones and the King Bees, Davy Jones and the Manish Boys,
But David, of course, had his own agenda where it was going to be Davy Jones in the lower third now, but next it's going to be David Bowie and whatever. So there was a side to David that wasn't revealed to you.
He was a rascal, mate. That's it. That's all I can really say about it.
On the 17th of September 1965, David Jones reinvented himself as David Bowie. He was 18 years old. Bowie and his fellow band members in shirts and ties.
I mean, I was always very vain. Then I found out that up in London, all the mods wore makeup, eyeshadow, and I thought that was really peculiar. I thought it looked rather good.
The group van was this London LCC ambulance. We lived in this ambulance as well as travelling to the gigs. So we were talking about how can we be different from everybody else. And David said, what about wearing makeup? Right, I said, makeup, okay. Now, I thought he meant clown makeup. Graham was driving as he always did. Yeah, I said, Dave's just come up with an idea. What about we wear makeup? So Graham turned around, fuck that.
Conservatively dressed people on a street.
Years later, I had the same problems. I didn't actually tell the spiders that we'd have to wear makeup. I said, you looked very green tonight on stage. I think if you wore makeup, you'd probably look a little more natural looking. Poor changing
man, snug into the city. The Gene Genie, David Bowie and the Spiders from Mars. Bowie has long red hair, dangly earrings, a chain around his neck, and a multi-coloured jacket over his bare upper body.
Everything tastes nice. Actually, when they realised how many girls they could pull when they looked so otherworldly, they took to it like a fish to water.
David had such a wide, eclectic taste in things, he thought, well, let's have a go at this because it's completely different. It's going to throw people off balance, I'm sure. And let's see how it goes. And we did that with our set on stage. Mostly it was David's own compositions, but we'd do hits by the Kinks or the Who. But we'd also do things like Chim Chimmery from Mary Poppins.
Chim chimney, chim chimney, chim chim cherry. A sweep is as lucky can be.
Chim chimney, he said. I thought, why are we doing that stuff?
Looking back on it, it just felt like a lot of fun at the time and quite kind of mischievous. I mean, you laugh a lot when you're young. You know, it was just a lot of it was really funny.
A BBC radio DJ.
Greetings, Pop Pickers. It's Pick of the Pops.
David told us we got an audition at the BBC. This was, wow, you know, I mean, something special to BBC. So we walked into the BBC and did our three numbers. Out of Sight, Chim Chimmery, and Baby That's a Promise. That's one of David's songs. We did that, came away, and then waited for the results.
I've been having second thoughts about this, and I'd like to hear more from the music department.
Well, frankly, to me, this savours too much of a gimmick.
They said it was quite a different sound, especially in the Mary Poppins number. And the treatment of Chim Chimmery kills the song completely. You cheeky sods. Routine beat group, strange choice of material, amateur sounding vocalist who sings wrong notes and out of tune, yes. Group has nothing to recommend it. I don't think the group will get better with more rehearsal. The singer is a Cockney type, but not outstanding enough. Well, you need to be an outstanding Cockney, obviously, for the BBC. There is no entertainment in anything they do. An inoffensive, pleasant nothing, backing a singer devoid of personality.
where are these people now? And each one says, no, 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 no. So, that was our post-mortem, I suppose. We failed. But we got a recording contract with Tony Hatch. This, to me, was awe-inspiring.
Tony Hatch, producer, Pye Records.
I'd written and produced the song Downtown with Petula Clark. I'd produced Sandy Shaw's first hit. And when somebody called me and said, we have this artist, and he really has got great talent, and he writes all his own things, I was more than happy.
David came up with Can't Help Thinking About Me. We rehearsed it, played it at the Marquee, and then took it into the studio and recorded it with Tony Hatch.
Can't Help Thinking About Me was released in January 1966.
I thought this has got the shape of a hit. It's structured well. It has a very strong hook. I can't help thinking about you. I can't help thinking about you. I don't know where you found this, but it is a piano. In case anybody wondered what it was. Question time, that
says I've brought dishonor. Can't help thinking about me. Well, this came out of trials in short story writing. Little things about leaving home and stuff like that. Mother says that she can't
stand the neighbours talking. Aged six, Bowie moved to the London suburb of Bromley. Leave this home,
start walking. Yeah. I couldn't really relate to America too well. So I started writing more about Bromley and Beckham. I tell a story from beginning to end. Remember when we used to go
to church on Sundays? Jeff McCormack, childhood friend and musician.
He was certainly a different child, and I think you could tell he was gifted, even at that age, 8 or 9 years old, a thinker.
George Underwood.
The difference with him and other kids was that David had interests in things that other kids didn't have. He was brought ahead of his time regarding, you know, reading and music and all the things which he was into.
Tony Hatch.
There are some songwriters that are just commentators, but Bowie was a storyteller, and so he was going to ravage into all his experiences to find things that he could write about. It was something new.
The single flopped, and Bowie's time with the lower third was over. Calls my name. Hi, Dave. A queue of young people on a street, then a reporter.
Und dieser Eingang hier dürfte wohl einigen von euch sehr, sehr vertraut sein. Es ist London's top teenage club, der Marquee.
By early February 1966, Bowie had recruited a new band. Hand in hand, they watch me cry. The Buzz. His next single was Do Anything You Say. John Hutch Hutchinson, guitar, The Buzz.
David wanted The Buzz to play sessions and we would be his band on stage. He wanted a band that was very much a backing band so that he would be the front man as a separate entity.
British boy whose career will surely develop him into one of the bigger names in the showbiz field. He's a great attraction here at the Marquee, and his name is David Bowie.
David, you're working with a backing group, The Buzz. Have you always been with them?
As David Bowie, yes.
Why do you say as David Bowie? You worked...
I was somebody else before that.
This is what, your second record, and it's a song you wrote?
Yes, I write most of the stuff I record, the B-sides and A-sides.
Dana Gillespie.
I don't think people realised how important the Marquee was as a venue. It was the hottest place to go, as far as I'm concerned. I wouldn't have said that I would have gone specially to see his act at the Marquee Club. I went mainly to see some of what I call the hotter bands. I would sit in the audience and gape at the Yardbirds or the Who.
Do Anything You Say flopped. After three singles with Tony Hatch, Bowie was dropped from the label.
The record company decided it didn't matter what I was going to make with David, they were losing faith. His songs, they weren't good enough to actually capture everybody's imagination. You know, it still isn't that unique Bowie magic.
David was never the success that all his other contemporaries were. Because of being that much younger, you could say that he almost had missed the boat. But he was a very driven man, even from those early days, but he always was helpful to me. You know, I always felt I was kind of a fellow musician with him. Love never came into it, which, thank God, you know, if you're going to fall in love with Bowie, you might as well kiss your sanity goodbye, because he loved himself extremely, always did, and I was quite happy with that.
A view across rooftops.
At one point, David said, "Do you want to come home and meet my parents?" I said, "Yes, why not?" That meant taking the train to Bromley.
You find yourself in the middle of two worlds. There's the extreme values of people who grew up in the countryside and the very urban feel of the city. And suburbia, you're given the impression that nothing culturally belongs to you, that you are sort of in this wasteland.
David lived in Sunridge Park, a mile or so from the centre of Bromley, and it was quite quiet. There wasn't not a lot happening there. You know, a corner pub, a couple of shops.
A photo of Bowie's stern parents, John and Peggy Jones.
When I was in his parents' house, they're facing a television, and the parents were sitting there quite quiet. They offered me some tuna fish sandwiches. But then there was silence, and I'm somebody that, I mean, I can talk to anybody, and it was hard going. It was soulless. Once they'd gone out, he said, "Whatever it takes, I want to get out of here. I do not want to live like this."
I think there's a passion for most people who have an iota of sort of curiosity about them to escape and get out and try and find who one is, and you find some kinds of roots, you know, and a desperation and exhaustion with the blandness of where we grew up.
So London was magnetic for us. It was somewhere we wanted to belong in, and I think that's why David writes about it so often in his early career.
He would want to write songs from the perspective, like Ray Davies did, really, of a London boy. He always wanted it to be homegrown.
Bluebell strikes another night.
The London Boys was a B-side recording released in 1966.
You bought some coffee, butter and bread. You can't make a thing, 'cause the meat is dead.
In 2000, Bowie re-recorded the London Boys for the unreleased album Toy. Mark Platy, producer, Toy.
What struck me was just a lot of them were really, they were great songs. They just had, people didn't know about them yet. He just wasn't David Bowie per se, as we know him today. For him to revisit these early songs of his, it's just a very typical thing for him to do. You hear the Bowie in the early songs. Like, he's already there. He's, you know, he's bubbling to the surface, but he's already there.
You hope you make friends with the guys you meet. Somebody shows you around. And you've met the London Boys.
Musicians from the album Toy: Earl Slick, Gail Ann Dorsey, and Mark Platy, all playing guitars.
That's not your typical 60s pop song, is it?
None of it was. London Boys is a really good example of David using his natural accent to sing to make the point.
Right.
If you're going to write a song called London Boys and you are from London and it's about you being a young man in London, yeah, then the accent really drives the point home.
I think he even exaggerated a little bit. It's almost like theater. It's
he's doing
a song, and whatever that theme of that song is, he's putting on the character vocally that tells the story the right
way, and he's
brilliant at that.
Performing the London Boys live at BBC Radio Theatre 2000. You've got it, my-
So much of what any teenager or young person writes comes from a sense of uniqueness.
Other than just rock music, there has always been a history of the rebel, of not being drawn to the tyranny of the mainstream.
I really am open to influence and new ideas and old ideas as well. I don't put up a block on things. Dear mistress and cure his... I was one of the first kids in Britain to have the Velvet Underground album. I know that for a fact because somebody had brought me back a demo copy of it before it was even released in America.
The Underground were, I thought, the most incredible sound. There was this sort of mixture of rock and avant-garde, and the combination was so brutal.
I don't think David lacked confidence in himself. He probably always knew that he was very adaptable, and it was more a question of him getting on the right track to do the thing that would take him furthest. And it obviously took him a long time to do that, with the lower third and then the buzz and the other things that he did.
In early 1967, Bowie briefly joined another band, the Riot Squad. Well, I know you had it bad. Del Roll and Butch Davis.
I think the attraction for David was he was looking to move forward and be a lot more adventurous with his musical styles. And we were looking for a singer that was totally flexible. But then David made it plain, really, right from the get-go, that he wanted to go more left field, if that's the right term, musically. And already he was talking about Velvet Underground.
He knew what he wanted and he was there to do it. He just wanted a backing band with extra goodies put in, which he did. He started to have him face painted. We started to go in more outrageous. He was coming over to me, can I draw just a petal on your face or a flower on your cheek? I said, yeah, do what you want with my face.
I'm waiting for my man Demo with the Riot Squad.
Waiting for my man. 26 dollars in my hand.
David thought, I'm waiting for my man. It did have gay connotations.
I'm waiting for my man to take him home. And as the act went, David was out front and everybody used to march up behind him in close contact. I didn't because I was on the organ, but you had Bob Evans flag, you had David Bowie, Bob Evans, Rod Davis, who was lead guitar, used to go around the stage as really as a homosexual thing, I'm waiting for him, and I'm really close contact together. You remember that?
No.
You can't remember that?
I can't, no, I'm laughing at the fact you're talking about but you being on the organ and people...
Oh, I say, yeah.
Oh, pardon me, sir, it springs to my mind. I'm just looking for a good friendly band. I'm waiting for my man.
But yeah, some great ideas for that time. But David's time with us was 8 weeks, 25 gigs, that's all.
Maybe he just felt overnight, you know, he's done his bit with us and now I want to move on to something a bit more theatrical.
Kenneth Pitt, Bowie's manager.
I was looking for someone who could be an all-round entertainer. And I thought in David we had found someone who could be.
When we first went to the DRAM label, the man who was in charge of the album department said to me, "This is the greatest thing that's come here since Tony Newley."
Anthony Newley, actor, singer, songwriter, and entertainer.
And he was a funny sort of guy, very much a cockney, lovable cockney kind of character. And David wanted to be Anthony Newley all the way through doing all the other stuff.
Maybe tomorrow I'll find what I'm after. I'll throw off my sorrow, beg, steal, or borrow my share of laughter.
The thing is, I never thought that I could sing very well, and I used to kind of try on people's voices if they appealed to me when I was a kid, about 15, 16. So I started singing like Anthony Newley. And so I was writing these really weird Tony Newley type songs. I thought, yeah, this is my bag.
Rubber Band. Rubber Band was Bowie's first single for his new label, DRAM. It was another flop. Gus Dudgeon, recording engineer, speaking in 1992.
He just had such wacky songs. About the only thing that used to bother us was he sounded like Anthony Newley all the time. So, I mean, to the point that, you know, we used to comment on it, and David would just say, well, I can't sing any other way. We knew bloody well he could, but he just had a fixation to the point that as soon as he opened his mouth, Anthony Newley shot out, you know, and it was like he just had no control over it.
I hope you break
Bowie's second single for DRAM was The Laughing Gnome.
Go on!
Carlos Alomar, guitar, 1974 to 2001.
That's very, very simple.
I was walking down the high street when I heard footsteps behind me, and there was a little old man in scarlet and grey chuckling away.
One of the great influences that, you know, he had was Anthony Newley. Which to me, I didn't get that. Who got it was my wife, Robin. He was singing once, and Robin looked at me and went, "Did he just Anthony Newley us?" I said, "Yes, I think he did, honey."
I'd always associate Laughing Gnome with Gus Dudgeon because he used to sit there doing tricks with his glasses whilst I was making it. Because we had the technology.
Get down with it. Woo! Fuck off. Hey, hey, hey.
He said, right, we need some gnome voices on this thing. And I showed him it could be done. And he went, oh, well, that's it. We've got to do it.
Catch me!
Mike Vernon.
You have to slow the tape down to pretty much the half speed and sing normally. We did quite a lot of takes and got very silly and got very rude at times, and there were some obscenities that we can't possibly talk about. But everyone had a good time doing it.
Come on, Fred! Ha, ha, ha.
Said the Laughing Gnome.
In a way, David's also very clever. That simplicity aspect, I think, is very, very important. I mean, his love for the Velvet Underground and the whole Lou Reed thing, and the simplicity of Waiting for the Man. Waiting for the man. That same pulsation. I was walking. It's exactly the same. Waiting for the man. Two chords. I mean, Fame is three chords. And so this simplicity is amazing. And it's totally relevant. But the Velvet Underground was cool. There's nothing cool about the Laughing Gnome.
The Laughing Gnome was Bowie's eighth single. It too failed to dent the charts.
Everything he did kind of failed. The Laughing Gnome, that single that he loathed, didn't give him satisfaction. I don't know how he coped with this, except that I do know that if you want something hard enough and it's not happened, it only makes you want to go on and want it even more.
Decca Studios, London, 1937 to 1980. By early 1967, Bowie was finishing his debut album with producer Mike Vernon.
Oh my word. 54 years or so of history coming back at me. Bowie was young. He was trying to make a mark for himself. And he was very much a Jack the Lad, there's no two ways about it. But, I mean, he was very funny to work with. We did have a lot of moments where we collapsed in laughter.
Four.
Where is Muckley's brass? Chris Grimshaw and a lemonade sandwich out on a... Oh, sure. That's where the men are.
David was an easy guy to get along with, you know. It's just that his songs were wild.
One, two, three, four.
They were totally quirky and off the wall, you know. And there are some really good songs, and there are emotions, and there are stories. And this was the one thing that Bowie was very good at. There's no discussion about it.
Love You Till Tuesday, from the album David Bowie.
Outside, little me is waiting, standing through the night. When you walk out through your door, I'll wave my flag and shout, ah, beautiful baby, my burning desire started on Sunday. Give me your heart and I'll love you till Tuesday.
Well, I might be able to stretch it till Wednesday.
The songs had a different viewpoint, singing songs that were appeared to be written by children. I don't remember ever hearing really any other song at that time that was a story that was apparently being told by children. It seemed to me completely unique.
Bowie's house, Plaistow Grove, Bromley. There Is a Happy Land, from the album David Bowie.
There is a happy land where only children live.
A woman stands outside the unremarkable mid-terrace house. She is Christina Amadeus, Bowie's cousin and writer.
Good heavens, it's been 60 years since I've been here. And I never ever used the front door. We always came in through the back alley. It's a
secret place. Passing through a white picket fence, she enters through the front door into a sitting room with two armchairs.
Go away, sir.
David used to do his performances on the windowsill over there. And David would go, ta-da! And he'd do his flower pot men. He would jump around with a terracotta pot on his head.
A photo of Bowie and his dad at the seaside.
His father, John, absolutely doted on him. But David's mum, Peggy, never became involved in games. She would sit and watch, but she would never enthuse, you know. She wouldn't be, oh, how wonderful, or anything like that. And she would often tell us we were being soppy.
Christina goes upstairs and enters a kid's bedroom.
Inchworm Danny Kaye conjures up my childhood for me. It's very sweet. And it was from the film Hans Christian Andersen.
A black and white photograph of a young Bowie looking out to the side with a serious expression.
Measuring the marigold.
Sounded so personal. And the person who was singing it sounded like he'd been hurt, too. And I think that really got to me, and it might have gone into the way I wrote a bit. You know, I've been hurt too.
Bowie crouched on the riverbank, fishing.
Often talking out your hurt, you know, is something I find that, you know, writers can do. And I may have done that a few times.
George Underwood, childhood friend.
David's mum was quite quiet, really. She didn't say a lot. I wasn't sure she liked me even, you know, because sometimes you think, well, maybe she doesn't like me. She's a bit quiet, but doesn't say anything.
I never saw her laugh or smile. Certainly not to me. And bless her heart, when she died, I wrote to David and said, I'm sorry about your mother, etc. I said, actually, she never quite took to me, your mother. And he wrote back to me and said, trouble is, Jeff, she never quite took to me either.
Smiling girls and rosy boys, come and buy my little toys.
Come and buy my toys from the album David Bowie.
David spent his entire life trying to win her approval. I think when David was young, he suffered a lot from the problems in his parents' marriage. They didn't engage in affectionate conversation with each other. John was very much in love with Peggy. Peggy would say to John's face, it was a marriage of convenience. And so there was this rift, and David had to be very careful. If he allowed his father to make too much of him, it would annoy Peggy. I think the most significant thing in David's life was that he was always striving for Peggy's love. I think he spent his life trying to win her approval.
Rich men's children running past their fathers dressed in hose. Golden hair and mud of many acres on their shoes.
A family at the beach. The mother rushes over with towels as the kids emerge from the sea.
Merry child, but come and buy my toys.
The idea of writing sort of short stories, I think that was quite novel at the time, excuse the pun. I was quite satisfied with the way things were going. I mean, I hadn't found any voice style and I hadn't found any way to perform.
David Bowie was released on the 1st of June 1967. At the time, it failed to register in the official album charts.
The Beatles' Sgt. Pepper, unfortunately, came out at the same time. I mean, it was pretty strong competition. There was, frankly, Bowie didn't stand a chance, really. And that's why the record, I guess, at the time, completely flopped. I mean, it didn't really do any business at all.
Lindsay Kemp, dancer, choreographer and boyfriend.
It was absolutely beautiful. It was the first time that I heard David. I loved all the songs, some more than others, I suppose. And it was that song, When I Live My Dream. When I live my dream, I'll be there. That starts the whole thing off. That's when I fell in love with him, for one thing.
When I live my dream, I'll take you with me. Riding on a golden horse.
Lindsay was using the DRAM album in his show. He was miming to certain aspects of this album. And news of that got to David, and therefore he went to see one of Lindsay's performances.
And the curtains opened, and there was a very beautiful man sitting in the front row, who turned out to be David Bowie. Well, he came round after the show and there was a kind of a tatty curtain which he pulled to one side. And it was like the Archangel Gabriel standing at this kind of light.
When I Live My Dream, from the album David Bowie.
Let them know it's just for now. Tell them that I've got a dream and tell them you're the star and goal.
He had a grace and a brain, as well as beauty. But he was funny. And, you know, I mean, beauty and humour are the two things that attract me the most. They got to have both of those if they're going to last more than a weekend.
We said, well, let's get together, you know. I'd love to write some more music for your show. And he said, well, I can't pay you because he wasn't earning anything. Yeah, I said, well, look, that's all right because I want to learn mime. So in exchange, you teach me mime and I'll work with you in the rest of the music.
A play, Piero in Turquoise, 1970.
Piero takes the stage to play for all. For here's a life his fortune rules, forsaken by his Columbine.
The premiere was at the Oxford Playhouse. So we got paid a nominal kind of fee from there. And we transferred to the West End. Albeit West 11. Notting Hill, which was not quite so fashionable then as it is now, and the tiny Mercury Theatre, the home of a British ballet. And I think it sat 120 seats, so we didn't make much money. Need I say more? But nobody came at all. Nobody came at all.
Till the day my dream cascades around me, I'm content to let you pass me by.
I thought, well, here I am, I'm a bit sort of mixed up creatively. I've got all these things going I like doing at once on stage or whatever. I'm not quite sure if I'm a mime or a songwriter or a singer. Why am I doing any of these things anyway? And I realised it was because I wanted to be well known.
Tell them I'm a dreaming kind of guy.
1968/1969.
I've always been a very curious and enthusiastic person. I just had to accept that I was a person that had a very short attention span, would move from one thing to another quite rapidly, and I got bored with the other.
Ground control to Major Tom, your circuit's dead. There's something wrong, can you hear me, Major Tom?
Somehow, I knew that what I was doing was important. Taking elements from areas that really shouldn't sit comfortably with each other.
In late January 1968, Bowie met a classical dancer.
Her name was Hermione Farthingale, and I absolutely adored her. I mean, she was the real first love in my life. And she was a ballet dancer.
We did fall in love. It took maybe 5 minutes, maximum. He was a lad, a youth lit. He was very, very young, looked ridiculously young. He looked about 8. And in fact, when I first went out with him, it did sort of bother me a little bit. You know, I sort of had to keep reminding myself he was actually 21.
And we talk with our eyes of the sweetness in our lives, and tomorrow's a rich surprise.
Hermione was a couple of notches up, you know. She was posh.
John Hutchinson.
But really nice. They did look like mirror images, so they fit together.
Our life was not regular. Neither of us were working 9 to 5. It wasn't a very rock and roll life either. Occasionally we had a glass of white wine. And Davey wasn't even very good at having a spliff. Baby,
baby. Let me sleep beside you. In 1968, David and Hermione lived together in South Kensington, London. Bob Harris, broadcaster and friend.
David was, I have to say, the perfect English gentleman. I mean, I remember, for example, when he and Marnie sat down for dinner, David held the chair for her and pushed the chair in for her, and being very polite, easygoing, and very lovely people.
In the early days, he wasn't happy professionally at all because it was a sort of massive struggle that whole year.
But I remember there was this endless period where I was like scrubbing out people's kitchens. I know I did that, anything to pick up a few dollars. But I needed something that didn't tie me down in any way, so if an audition came along or whatever, I'd be free to do it, you know?
But by August, it suddenly came to him that what he wanted to do was this mixed media performance.
Black and white stills of Bowie and Hermione performing together.
I was in a mixed media group, which means that one of us could dance, another one could sing, and another one had some poetry, and we put it all together and went underground. It was called Feathers, and the girl was Hermione, and the guy was Hutch on guitar.
Ching-a-ling, Feathers.
David and Feathers, we could do a song quite heavy and quite deep, but you can change the mood on a gig by doing something with it. A nice snappy guitar riff, and Ching-a-ling song was fine. It was a good song, and it had, you know, that was unusual in its way.
Ching-a-ling was based on David's 12-string, his traveling piano. You know, that's what he used all the time to write on. And as long as he stayed on that instrument, songs were going to come out that way. There was, you know, you can't play like rock riffs on the 12-string. You just can't.
You'd try one thing, try another. If it didn't work out, that was absolutely fine, and just move on to the next. But he wasn't lost. He just wasn't found either.
We used to do some mime pieces, you know, and it was like just throwing in everything I knew to keep an audience's attention more than anything else.
I can't remember the specifics of his performance other than what I photographed.
Ray Stevenson, photographer.
It was pretty much like mime exercises, but a bit extra. It didn't really do it for me, but the man did.
Sell me a coat, Feathers.
I didn't shoot colour of David because it seemed like a waste. Colour, whole different thing, and expense. Yeah, he was obviously not going to be a massive star, so why would I want colour in my library?
David asked me to see it, a little show that he'd got together with Feathers.
I was walking home, and I happened to glance in the window of this junk shop, and there it was.
He did a piece called The Mask. David, I suppose, had seen Marcel Marceau along the line, but he wasn't Marcel Marceau. It was dreadful. I cringed. I really cringed.
Bowie, in a ruffled white shirt and white clown makeup, covers his face, then grins.
And there are always people that say, he was very good in that miming, wasn't he? And he was a load of shit.
Has that any of the criticism, any of the attacks hurt you?
Yes, everything hurts me very much. I'm very sensitive. But I put myself in that position, so that's what I'm in for, isn't it?
Feathers was never destined to last. He never said, let's the three of us get really famous together. It was a stepping stone.
A thoughtful Bowie walking in a park.
But I had also said to myself, am I actually going to be with David for the rest of my life? And I didn't think I was actually going to. He was clearly going somewhere. And I just didn't think I was going to tread that path with him.
In December 1968, Hermione landed a part as a dancer in a film.
Song of Norway was a big MGM spectacular which needed dancers for 7 months or so. It was something that nobody in their right mind would have turned down. I just thought, yeah, this is what I want to be doing. I suddenly realised that I had to pull out, stop.
Oh, God, yes, my heart broke. She was doing this funny romp in Norway with bits of ballet in it, and that she was cast in that. God, no, I didn't get over that for such a long time. It really broke me up.
I think he was vulnerable and he was scared of being abandoned. I think he was very hesitant about giving himself. And David must have been very frightened by all the comings and goings of various family members.
When I'm five, I will read the magazines in mommy's drawer.
When I'm five.
When I'm five, I will walk behind the soldiers in the...
I have a cousin who's very dear to me, who was shuttled around from family to family and came and stayed with us for a while. My mother had children that I never really knew about, but that were also shifted off to another family. It just seemed everybody in the family had this kind of attribute of being in transition from one stage to another.
When I'm five, I will catch a butterfly and eat it, and I won't be sick.
I think I'd realised that the transitory nature of life was something that we all had to deal with.
I think one of the reasons he was so very good as a child, and he was because he was afraid he'd be given away too.
Space Oddity.
Bound control to Major Tom, your circuit's dead. There's something wrong. Can you hear me, Major Tom?
I related it to myself a lot more than anything I'd written up until then. There was something about it that touched areas of my fears about my own insecurities socially and maybe emotionally. This feeling of isolation that I had ever since I was a kid was really starting to manifest itself. I think the isolation of the film 2001 made itself very obvious when I wrote the song Space Oddity, because for the first time I really felt a sense of how you could write as an isolationist. I thought, well, gee, I am Major Tom. Here I am in my own cosmic space, and nobody can possibly understand what it's like to be out here on this umbilical cord attached to my craft.
Unreleased early demo of Space Oddity.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom.
The demo featured Hutch on dual lead vocals.
Take your protein pills and put your helmet on.
David wrote it as a song for two people, Ground Control and Major Tom. David would sing the lead and I would come up with the easiest way for me to sound right as the harmony voice.
Two, check ignition and may God's love be with you.
Blast off!
Not only that, I should have been on the record as Ground Control, obviously. But I'd left. I was in a drawing office in Scarborough by then.
This is Major Tom to Ground Control. I'm stepping through the door. And I'm floating in the most peculiar way. Can I please get back inside now, if I may?
When I heard the demo of Space Oddity, I didn't like it all that much, and I handed it to Gus Dudgeon. He really loved David.
I said, Tony, you're crazy. Are you sure you don't want to do this song? He said, no, you want to do it, obviously. I said, I can't wait. And so he said, well, you do that on the B-side, and I'll do the rest of the album. I said, OK, fine.
If Gus were alive, which he isn't, unfortunately, he would be presenting this to you. And I was really, really impressed with the job that David and Gus Dudgeon had done on this. What makes this work is drama. The first thing you hear is an ominous 12-string guitar fade up from nothing. So all that is quite dramatic. That's not your average pop song. But, you know, it doesn't hit you in the face, doesn't hit you in the head. It's drama, and you are sucked into it. So this is a very clever device that he used.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom.
So David used this revolutionary new instrument, the mighty little stylophone. So it all adds to the kind of science fiction quality of the song.
Check ignition and may God's love be with you.
Very dramatic liftoff, isn't it?
This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade.
And another new thing it had on it, which the Beatles kind of debuted, was the Mellotron.
Rick Wakeman, Mellotron on Space Oddity.
David wanted it because he wanted it to sound not like strings, but like strings. And I knew exactly what he meant. It's recorded strings, it's the tapes inside. But one of the problems you have with this instrument is that a note only lasts 8 seconds, and then it cuts out. So if you hold a chord long enough, and sometimes you need to hold it for a lot longer than 8 seconds, after you get to the 8 second mark, it starts to do that, which is why I hated the bloody thing, to be brutally honest with you.
And the papers want to know whose shirts you wear. Now it's time to leave the capsule if you dare.
Covered it in echo to get the actual sound that David wanted, which I have nicked ever since to use on Yes Records.
Two and plus 100,000 miles, I'm feeling very scared.
In July 1969, Space Oddity was released. It was Bowie's first hit, reaching number 5 in the UK charts.
Tell my wife I love her.
David, the record which you have in our charts in Britain at the moment is undoubtedly your biggest success to date, isn't it?
My only success to date.
When he had the big hit with Space Oddity, that's where the change came, where he started seeing himself as a star.
Planet Earth is blue, and there's nothing I can do.
People knew who David Bowie was then. He was the Major Tom guy, and they'd say, "Hey, Major Tom," and all that. People would see him, you know, and which he loved. He absolutely loved it.
Bowie received his first significant award in May 1970.
But I said, "You'll never write another song like this again," and he didn't. What he did come up with was something no one dreamt about at the time. He was the first rock star to take on a different identity. In other words, it was Ziggy Stardust by David Bowie. That was his stroke of genius.
Off the record, what everybody told me is that, "David, you've got to have a single." So I said, "Right, I'll go away and I will write an archetype single in my style based on loosely on Space Oddity."
Right.
"So that people say, this is what we were waiting for from David Bowie as a follow-up to Space Oddity." That's Starman. Starman was strictly, I wrote it in about 15 minutes. I used every cliche phrase I could think of to do with Starman and people in space bath and let's right. children boogie and all that. Shoved it in 3 minutes and on a nice tune.
Starman, 1972.
Didn't know what time it was and the lights were low. I leaned back on my radio. Some cat was laying down some "Get It On Rock and Roll," he said.
sound, it seemed to fade. It came back like a slow voice on a wave of fade. Is that one old DJ that was hazy cosmic jive?
Do you enjoy being a rock star?
Fantastic. I'm just brilliant. I'm missing a ride. I've never really thought, I'm going to make my mark as a... I just thought, I'd be David Bowie, the first David Bowie, that's all.
Starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he blew our minds. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He told us not to blow it.
John Cambridge, drums, Space Oddity album.
When we did the Space Oddity album in Trident Studio, David used to walk about like he was a star. You could see, just by, he could walk into a pub and you'd think, he's going to be a star, and you could say, you know, that. But not necessarily by his music or his playing at that time, you know. He was a bit like a folky singer, you know? He wasn't like the rock god he became. But then again, David was very deep, you know. He would never... wore his hat on his sleeve. He'd never come out to you and say, I'm really worried about this one, you know. He would just ride over it.
But on Space Oddity, the album, Bowie returned to his relationship with Hermione.
So rest your head and read a treasure dream.
Letter to Hermione from the album Space Oddity.
I tear my soul to cease the pain. I think maybe you feel the same. What can we do?
So I wrote my letter to Hermione on my album. There, that'll show her. I write something that public and she'll see that she really messed me up.
Tony Visconti, producer and friend.
He was definitely feeling that song. That was him being vulnerable. I think we only did one or two takes. There was no reason to keep recording it and do it one more time better. He just did that performance, and it was heart-tugging.
They say your life is going
very... Hermione performing in a dance studio, then at home.
They say you sparkle like a different girl. But something tells me that you hide. When all the world is warm and tired, you cry a little in the dark. Well, so do I.
Did I cry? Probably.
I'm not quite sure what you're supposed to say.
I missed him terribly. We missed each other as friends, apart from anything else. You know, that's what we really missed.
Quite sure what I'm supposed to do.
Hermione, with her long flowing hair, walking through a woodland.
To you.
Despite having a hit single with Space Oddity, the album was not a success. /1971.
I still don't know what I was waiting for, and my time was running wild. A million dead end streets, and every time I thought I'd got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet.
It almost seemed that 1970 was the cumulative year for me. That's where it all sort of started to make sense.
Beckenham, Kent. A dog in a park. A photograph of Bowie with long wavy hair.
I took this walk to ease my mind. Find out what's gnawing at me.
By 1970, Bowie was living with his new girlfriend, Angela Angie Barnett.
I was living in this huge, almost neo-Gothic pile down in Beckenham called Haddon Hall, which had some kind of baronial hall, entrance hall type thing. And the band that we collected together, Visconti and at the time Angela, all kind of shared this baronial hall. So it kind of a commune thing.
Angie in a red tunic with bare legs.
Angie, when I met her, was this free spirit. She was outspoken, had courage like you wouldn't believe. She could walk up to anybody and give them a piece of her mind or get things. And Angie was the one who made things happen.
In February 1970, Bowie invited guitarist Mick Ronson to Haddon Hall.
Mick came from Hull, you know, he was very down to earth. But when I first heard him play, I thought, oh, that's my Jeff Beck. He is fantastic, this kid is great. And so I sort of hoodwinked him into working with him.
You get a song and you sit there and you just play it on the acoustic guitar and sing it. I kind of just watched him and kind of played through everything and I guess everybody kind of liked it. I played classical piano, you know, and I played violin. And with David kind of pushing you into doing these different things, and that was really good too because he encouraged you to do these things.
My new band is called Hype. Tony Visconti on bass, Mick Ronson on guitar, and John Cambridge on drums, and myself on rhythm guitar and keyboard thing.
The Width of a Circle, David Bowie and Hype. The best. I would sit and blame the master first and last. All the roads were straight and narrow, and the bears were small and yellow, and the rumour spread that I...
One of the first gigs that we did was in February 1970 at the Roundhouse with Hype.
And I think it was probably my first costume band.
And our respective girlfriends and wives and whatever put together all these really ridiculous, like, cartoon capers, comic hero costumes.
The Roundhouse gig with the costumes, that was Andy's idea. She said we should all get dressed up. And maybe David did want to maybe a bit in it as well, but Andy had a lot to do with it. I was cowboy man with a cowboy hat, and I had a frilly shirt.
Ronson was guitar gangster, and he wore sort of gangster's outfit. And I became this kind of spaceman, silver lame and all that. Tony was hype man. It's like a converted Superman type thing.
Over the years, I forgot the colors of this until I saw that video of us in color. You know, it was green and red and all that. I didn't even know what color it was. And then they made me, instead of a Superman cape, they made me a very big cape with wires in it. So I had this collar.
Atomic Sunrise Festival, Roundhouse, London, 1970.
We thought we were kind of, you know, smart, but nobody even looked at the stage. I mean, it was really just the most depressing night of our lives. All were minds in uni thought, hours weird by mystic thought. No, but I think I was getting nearer to what I wanted to do, which is to create this alternative world, which is what I ultimately ended up doing with the Ziggy thing.
In April 1970, Woody Woodmansey replaced John Cambridge as Bowie's drummer.
I got a call from David. I've got this place in Beckenham in Kent called Haddon Hall, and we all live there. And I'm doing another album, you know, will you come? So I was like, ooh.
From Beside Bowie, the Mick Ronson story.
So it was like a mansion, and it was real cheap too, you know, because David only paid £7 a month, and £7 a month is nothing, you know. There was a lot of things went on there, you know.
Mick and I slept on the landing in sleeping bags. I remember waking up one morning, there was a... I just heard giggling and screaming down below through the banisters. I looked down and there was like 10 naked females prancing about downstairs.
A black and white slapstick comedy.
I never saw 10 naked women. I saw two. But people were trying to get into my bedroom and climb into bed with Liz and myself. And it was like, mate, you're in the wrong room. Go back in that room, you know. It's not like a bordello. which it kind of resembled after a while.
He never quite knew what was going to happen. And then David would come down the staircase in the dress. You know, you'd never seen that before. It's a man's dress. I said, yeah, I assumed that, you know.
It was definitely a man's dress, although it zipped up in the same way as a woman's. We all wore dresses at that time, and no, we didn't.
In January 1970, Bowie began writing his next album, The Man Who Sold the World.
I was still very much trying to find who I was as a writer, and electric music was appealing to me more and more, especially the heavier kind of guitar-oriented things.
Bowie holding up a playing card, the King of Diamonds. Bob Harris.
In The Man Who Sold the World, it's not completely disconnected from the Led Zeppelin-style heavy metal that was beginning to arrive as well. I think all the sounds that he's going through are things that he's listening to, having a look at, pulling into the next record and you know, using that and going on from there.
Footage from the Vietnam War. Running Gun Blues from the album The Man Who Sold the World.
On Man Who Sold the World, he was starting to get more of a concept of I'll do what I want to do, lyrically, particularly, and song-wise. Man Who Sold the World opened the floodgates. I think he was learning that his ideas could be put across, and I think the times when he didn't compromise on what he wanted to say were the successful things.
All the Mad Men, from the album The Man Who Sold the World.
They send my friends away to mansions cold and grey.
One of my sort of half-siblings meant so much to me in my early years, and his name is Terry. He's my half-brother, my mother's son.
To the far side of town.
A photo of Terry Burns.
Men stalk the streets while the signs stay underground.
Terry probably gave me the greatest education that I could ever have had. I mean, he just introduced me to the outside things. And I guess Terry had shown me that there has always been a history of the outside, of the rebel, of not being in the center, not being drawn to the tyranny of the mainstream. But then he would go away for long periods. One period he went away and joined the RAF. And when he came back, he had changed considerably and was showing very evident signs of schizophrenia. And then he went into hospital, and he stayed in hospital for the rest of his life.
Day after day, they tell me I can go.
Footage of Cane Hill Hospital.
I can blow to the far side of town.
A photo of Bowie's mother with Terry.
Cause it's such a long way down.
Bowie in full Ziggy Stardust makeup. Red face, gold lips, gold disc on the forehead. Women banging at the door.
I will do me harm.
Insanity was something that I was terribly fearful of. But I felt that I was the lucky one, because as long as I could put those psychological excesses into my music, then I could always be throwing it off.
One of the Porkies that David perpetuated for a very long time was that he came from a family where insanity seemed to be the norm. And it just wasn't true. Yes, Terry had his breakdown, but I believe it was a bad acid trip.
Bowie leaves a venue and jumps into a car.
Every arrangement we did on the Man Who Sold the World album, we started them in Haddon Hall, but we finished most of the album in the studio and made up our own parts on the spot. And David would go off into the hallway and write the lyrics. I'd go out half an hour later, and he'd just be holding hands with Angie. And I go, come on, write the damn lyrics, for God's sake. The Man Who Sold the World was written, the lyrics were written on the same day we recorded it, which was the last day of the album.
The Man Who Sold the World as a song was kind of about meeting himself in the future and where he'd been, and you kind of, that's the picture you, or I had in my head.
We passed up on the stairs. He spoke of was and when.
A photo of long-haired Bowie split in half, with several of his earlier looks appearing on the other half.
His friend, which gave us some.
The album once again failed to sell.
Spoken to his eyes, I thought you died alone a long, long time ago.
I thought at the time, okay, it's pretty hard rock and progressive, a lot of it. So imagine you've got a Zeppelin album, a Sabbath album, and this guy in a dress. It's not going to happen just from the cover alone.
Glastonbury Festival 2000. This was the second time Bowie had played Glastonbury. The first was on the 23rd of June, 1971. John Coleman, friend and Glastonbury co-organiser, 1971.
I was having to create a bill out of nothing. And so I started off with people that I liked and knew. And so I rang David and said, are you interested in doing it? Got Angie, who said, no, he's doing some solo gigs and he's not enjoying them very much. In her inimitable way. And then I rang again and got David a couple of days later, and he said, well, I'm kind of interested in doing it.
I got out to the stage about 5:30 in the morning. And when I hit the stage, nobody knew any of my songs. I'd just written this one called Oh, You Pretty Things.
Wake up, you sleepy head. Put on some clothes, shake off your bed. No. This is about Homo Superior. You're letting the lyrics down badly.
David, Angie and I went to Glastonbury, and I do remember people crawling out of their sleeping bags and their tents, and he was up there on his own.
I still don't know what I was waiting for. And my time was running wild, a million dead end streets, and every time I thought I'd got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet.
Then a few more arrived, and then a few more arrived, and then people were running around waking people up. I could see people. I could see little scurrying figures up the hillside from my seat on the side of the stage, until eventually there were about 400 or 500 people there.
Of how the others must see the faker.
The sun was out, it was warming up, and these people had obviously thought they were the only people on the planet that had discovered this young man, and it really was an important moment for a lot of people.
I tell you what, I just want to say that you've given me more pleasure than I've had in a good few months of working, and I don't do gigs anymore because I got so pissed off with working and dying a death every time I worked, and it's really nice to have somebody appreciate me for a change.
71 is when I got down to seriously writing and trying to not diversify too much. I was trying to be a one-man revolution.
Bob Grace, Bowie's music publisher.
I know exactly what he wanted. He told me, he said, world domination. He said there was absolutely no doubt that he was going to be, you know, a world-class superstar that he became. And that's what he wanted.
Still don't know what I was waiting for. Time by million dead streets and every time.
Between 1971 and 1973, Bowie released two albums.
Then I told
myself to face me, but I never caught a glimpse.
The first, Hunky Dory, didn't enter the charts on release.
I'm much too fast to take that test. Challenges.
But with the second, Ziggy Stardust, Bowie at last found real success. Touring extensively, Bowie was now a star.
God came to me and he said, let there be Ziggy, you know, and I just saw the world in another kind of fashion. And it was about pushing together all the pieces and all the things that fascinated me culturally, a hybrid of everything I liked, just playing around with the idea of rock and roll.
He needed a vehicle, he needed a character to feel comfortable and to put his ideas across. It seemed like he really needed that, which was missing from all those earlier attempts at success.
The Aladdin Sane cover, featuring Ziggy, eyes closed, with a lightning bolt across his face. 1973. My Death, Russell Harty Plus, 17th of February, 1973.
My death waits like a beggar blind who sees the world through an unlit mind. Throw him a dime for the passing time. My death waits to allow my friends a few good times before it ends.
Is it difficult for you to do what you've just been doing in a tiny television studio? I mean, throwing yourself outwards.
I find singing and performing very easy, but this is awful. Never done this before, chat show like this.
No, but I mean,
find this very difficult.
Are you nervous?
Yes, very.
Oh, let's pick violets for the passing time. My death waits there in a double bed. Sails of oblivion at my head. Pull up the sheets again.
How long do you give it?
What, me?
Yeah.
How long do I give me?
Yeah. How many years do you give yourself? I don't mean how many years to give yourself in life, but how many years can you be ahead of the glamour field and ahead of the bitter field?
No, I've never been ahead of anything. I've been, I think, on my own. I'm not in an Olympics.
3rd of July, 1973. Hammersmith Odeon, London.
The artist is strictly a figment of people's imagination. I really believe that. We're the original false prophets. We are the gods.
We want it all.
You know, we want all the adulation and people to read the lyrics and everything just to play the game, you know. We don't exist. And I know that I feel that same emptiness that they all feel when they get there. Because they know that it's not real.
David didn't like a comfort zone. He could have done Ziggy for his whole life and he would have had fans, but he wanted to move on. So I knew Ziggy was not going to be long-lived.
Well, it's the last one tonight,
yeah. Is it? I heard it was last for all time, is that right?
We shall see at the end of the show. Yeah. Has been mentioned.
You're making an announcement, are you, tonight?
If that's the case, I will be.
I knew that it was a very important show. I knew he was nervous because something was really working and he spent a decade working to that.
Go away.
I can dig that you are nervous, but I really think the audience you have tonight, it's the easiest you've ever had.
Think so?
Oh, and how?
I'm an alligator. I'm a mama, papa calling for you. I'm a space invader. I'll be a rock and roller bitch for you.
Moon Age Daydream. Mike Garson, pianist, Ziggy Stardust tours, 1972/73.
The Hammersmith gig of the 1,000 shows I did with him had a mystique, an energy. This is something special. There was something electric about it.
Suffragette City. Hutch.
We'd finished the last song and David walked to my side of the stage and said, don't start Rock and Roll Suicide, which I play the intro on, until I tell you. So I figured he must be going to say, thanks for the tour, we'll see you in September or whatever. But he didn't.
Of all the shows on this tour, this particular show will remain with us the longest because... Not only is it the last show of the tour, but it's the last show that we'll ever do. Thank you.
I thought, okay, maybe this is a stunt. And then part of me was going, I've just got the sack. Live.
Time takes a cigarette, puts it in your mouth, pull on your finger, then another finger, then your cigarette. Well, the wall to wall is calling. It lingers, but still you forget. Oh, 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 you're a rock and roll suicide.
It did really seem odd that at the very height of his career, he was extinguishing it with a couple of phrases. It must have seemed to people, why would you do that? Why would you give it all up when you're just at the starting grid? Extraordinary night, an extraordinary statement.
You're a rock and roll suicide.
There was something very calculated about it, and I think what he had that most artists didn't have, he had a sense of what is commercial, what works, what can sell, in addition to his own integrity.
Don't let the sunlight blast your shadow. Don't let the milk flow mind to mine.
Ziggy Stardust was the culmination of all the things that David tried to do in the 60s. I think with Ziggy Stardust, he achieved the success that an individual like Ziggy Stardust would aim for. But David himself wasn't Ziggy Stardust. So I think he'd already stepped outside of that character back into being David Bowie.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye, we love you.
Bathed in red light, Bowie, as Ziggy Stardust, takes a bow.
To make the kind of breakthrough I needed, I had to put on a few trappings in the beginning. And I think now I will just be David Bowie, period. I've got music plans for the future.
In memory of Lindsay Kemp, 1938 to 2018.
Stay out tonight.